Welcome to episode 292 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on July 19th, 2022. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss a topic or recent news and how it relates to you. In this episode, there's some Azure news to share, but first, we spend a few minutes talking about OneDrive, known folder move, and Edge profiles. In Azure news, there are new Azure Premium SSD V2 disks with some really nice feature improvements over V1, the Azure Gateway Load Balancer reaches general availability, and the new cross-region load balancer helps with redundancy and low latency in Azure. Start the event. The event has started. Hopefully the audio is balanced.
That's whatever you've done with it.
I have not touched anything. So if the audio is unbalanced, I am blaming demons in the machine. Speaking of, I had my own demons in my machine. So we did this whole live. We did our live, the To the Cloud live YouTube the other day. And we had all kinds of issues, meaning I had all kinds of issues. And it was this weird CPU contention between what appeared to be Ecamm that we used to stream it, and OneDrive was way up there on my machine and a few other things. So we finally got it going when I just exited OneDrive. Since then, I have actually disabled the known folder move on my OneDrive for Mac. So this may not be Windows. This might be only Macs. The performance on my machine and the amount of CPU I have seen OneDrive consuming has drastically improved. So I don't know what known folder move is doing. I don't know if it's something with the M1. I don't know if it is how I use my desktop and my documents, which I rarely actually use, but it was interesting. So I need to do some more experiments around this.
Yeah. Is known folder move for macOS out of preview yet? So I know it came out in when they GA'd Apple Silicon support, they also announced that public preview for KFM.
I believe it is. Apple Silicon support in GA and KFM for macOS. I was just looking to see. I don't know. That's a good question. I thought it was known folder move, now GA for macOS. Back in April, it GA'd for macOS.
Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah, so I don't know. I have some other things that I was looking at too. I have an A10 Mini. And apparently in a recent update of that, they started doing auto backups of your config to your documents, and there's no way to turn it off. So I did notice this ATEM was like constantly writing XML files of a backup of itself to my documents folder. I don't know if that was messing with it because I use my ATEM for video, but if you are having performance issues on a Mac M1 and you do have your known folder move turned on, I would be interested to see if anybody else has seen something similar or if it's just me or, again, a combination of Ecamm and ATEM with known folder move. I know you found a Dropbox article too about Ecamm, about not syncing folders that Ecamm is writing temp files to with Dropbox. So there was a whole bunch of weird stuff going on there.
Yeah, I think that's a good tip in general with all of these synchronization apps. And it's maybe something a lot of us forget about over time because our home folder or our user directory in Windows, those used to kind of be safe places. Like you didn't always have to go out to say like on Windows to your primary drive, like your C drive, and create a temp folder at the root and then do all your work in there, because this type of thing didn't happen where you decided to sync your entire documents folder and your entire downloads folder and your desktop and everything else in between it. But now as these programs kind of come in like OneDrive or Dropbox and they pick up that functionality, there's all sorts of opportunities to have clashes and contention on the file side, depending on you and what you run. Like I know a big one that I've run into a lot in the past is Git repos and doing like a local clone of a Git repo and then having that play nice with synchronization software like Dropbox or OneDrive, because it just kind of all goes off the rails. If you have like a partial sync of a state file or something like that, it all goes bad and goes sideways on you very quickly. So if you have these things like Ecamm or really any piece of software that writes to local disk, it expects things to be in a certain state all the time, or it is a frequent writer. So it's doing lots of writes, whether they're small writes, large writes, whatever they happen to be, but kind of in place that some other engine has to keep up with and figure out what's going on. It's like, don't even bother. Just keep that stuff outside your synchronization folder space.
Yeah, it is definitely a good tip. And I had that with my Git repos too. I had to move those out because I originally had Git repos in my documents. And then I turned unknown folder move. And not only did I run into that, but I ran into some naming clashes. And it's like, okay, Git repos out of documents are going like to my root user directory.
Yeah. So definitely watch out for those kinds of things. And I think that's why you saw maybe companies like Microsoft, like I know organizations that have been in the past, like that are like PST heavy and things like that. PSTs tend to end up in user directories. And then all of a sudden you would have this same thing, right? A large monolithic database just sitting on local disk that's trying to be synced someplace else. And what's the state of it? And what are the bits that have changed? And the whole thing turns into a mess very quickly.
Like, I get the purpose of known folder move in terms of users are used to saving stuff to documents, to desktop, and you want them to be able to back up and be synchronized. That's the use case. In reality, from my experience so far, it's better to train users to save things to their OneDrive or to sync OneDrive to another location and save files there than try to auto-sync desktop or documents, because I have noticed you run into a lot of these weird things like this. But
I think there's stuff that can go sideways there. Like, downloads is a weird one to me. Like, things that I download tend to be ephemeral in my mind. Like, I'm going to download an installer, run the installer, delete the installer kind of thing. Like, I don't need that anymore. I'm going to download that PDF. I'm going to put a signature on it. I'm going to send it back to somebody else. Whatever. Desktop's another weird one. So most of us tend to end up not only with files on our desktops, but especially in the case of Windows, you end up with a lot of shortcuts. So that gets really weird really quick because you have shortcuts to applications you install. But if you sign into the same OneDrive account on multiple machines, but you have different applications installed, or maybe your user directory is in a different place, it can get strange pretty quickly. Documents makes total sense to me. It's really, I think, just the maybe the not so nice programs that treat your documents directory as a dumping ground for other things that aren't documents. They could be configuration, state of a program, something like that.
That was actually my frustration with the ATEM, was once I noticed this, I was like, I don't care about auto backup. My config of my ATEM Mini is not that complex. I don't want an auto backup. And if I do have auto backup, I want to be able to pick where my auto backup goes, but I couldn't do that. It created a folder in documents that dumped the auto backups there. There's no way to turn it off, no way to change the location, at least that I was able to find. But that was a bit of interesting discoveries after our latest YouTube Live the other week.
Yeah. Since we're here, why don't we do another macOS one? Because I know when folks love when this turns into a macOS show. Yes. But I think there's enough of us out there that sometimes you want to do the same types of weird things that you and I do. So I saw a tweet from Jeremy Thake at some point along the way, which called out, how do you open individual profiles on Microsoft Edge on macOS? So if you're on Windows and you're in Microsoft Edge, you would kind of probably be used to the behavior where you can go and as soon as you create a new profile, so you have profile one, profile two, when you launch profile one, it shows up in your taskbar. And you've got, hey, here's this little icon running and it's Edge running and it's all nice and happy. And then you go and open up profile two and you'll end up with a second icon in your taskbar. And same thing if you did profile three, profile four. And you'll end up with individual icons in your taskbar that represent each one of these profiles. And you can actually pin each one of those icons to your taskbar. You can even pin it to your start menu if you want to. And then what you can do is you can launch into individual profiles. So you get kind of a dedicated launch button to go ahead and come in and make that happen, which is all well and good and super nice and super easy. But on macOS, it's a little different. So on macOS, if you install Microsoft Edge or Chrome, anything like that, you can't use Safari because Safari doesn't have profiles, and that's why no one should use Safari. On macOS, you get one icon. And when you click that icon, it always launches your default profile or whatever the first profile was that you installed from. If you want to launch into a secondary profile, you can obviously open up the Edge window and click the ellipsis or the profile button and then go ahead and launch it that way. You can also right-click the icon in the dock and you can say, hey, go open up this other profile. But that's a little bit annoying. Sometimes we want to have like a dedicated launcher for it, or you want to do other things, like you might want to automate around it. So I'll use the podcast here as an example. I have an account in our podcast tenancy, and I use that account to log into, you know, WordPress where we host and, you know, pull links and do all that stuff and just kind of keep it off in its own profile. So what I want to do is when I want to start the podcast, I want to launch all my audio stuff. So I want to fire up Loopback and Audio Hijack and turn my microphone on and do all those kinds of things. But it would also be really nice if I could launch that dedicated profile for the podcast in Microsoft Edge. So it turns out this is like a really, I guess it seems like it's a fairly unknown thing.
It's, yeah. Every time I've looked for it.
On how to do it on the backside.
Every time I've looked for it, there's lots of instructions on how to do it on Windows and make like dedicated shortcut buttons and key combinations. I could not find it for how to do it on macOS. So I don't know why this is not that publicly known.
Yeah, I do this. So it was actually funny. I saw it pop up and I was like, oh, I've already done this, but I just haven't documented it or talked about it. But since it seems to maybe be a little bit of an unknown thing, why not go ahead and put it out there in the world? So it turns out it is totally possible to launch additional profiles from a button. Like In my case, I said, I do it on my Stream Deck through a shortcut. You could do it through like Launchpad, create a dedicated icon. Like there's a bunch of different ways you could do it. I know you said you're using Alfred and workflows inside of Alfred. So totally possible to do all this. Really the hardest part is figuring out which profile directory matches to which friendly name for a profile. So in the case of like my podcast profile, like when I go into Edge and I look at it, it says podcast. But when I go and look on the disk for where the preferences for that profile are stored, it's called profile one. So they don't exactly match up. So there's a little bit of kind of back and forth to figure out which friendly profile name matches to which profile directory on disk. But once you have that, it's just a matter of calling into the actual app package itself. So most people, I think on macOS or Linux land, you end up with just doing like an open-a. So what do I want to open? And then you might pass in an additional set of args to that, do like a --args and then try and throw things in. That doesn't work too well on macOS, but what you can do is just call into the app package. So like /applications, microsoftedge.app, /contents, macOS, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you can use just all the regular arguments at the end of that. So you can do like --, profile directory equals profile one. And you kind of wait a second and then you profit and you can move on from there. I'll put a link to the thread on Twitter. If anybody's on macOS and you want to do this, you're interested in like automating launching of profiles in Microsoft Edge on macOS, and you want to either do that through your dock or like I said, a Stream Deck, an Alfred workflow, you want to do it in Raycast, you know, whatever your launcher thing, automation thing of choice happens to be. A shortcut, you know, albeit. I'll put a link to that Twitter thread and also just a quick little gist up on GitHub, which hopefully helps out more than you, me, and Mr. Thake.
For sure, because I have tried it and I have started adding profiles to my Stream Deck to do this, and it is working well so far. There's a few goofy things with it that I wish were different. Like, I wish if I pushed the profile button and I already had a window open with that profile, it would switch to that instead of opening a new window. I'm going to have to go see if I can find some more arguments and stuff that I can pull in. But it does work to launch those new windows with those profiles and assign keyboard shortcuts to it and all of that with different methods. Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at IntelliJink.com/podcast. That's IntelliJink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business. So, moving out of macOS world into Azure land. Should we go into Azure land now?
Sure.
Let's Azure land.
I saw just for you. It's your show.
No, you had stuff you wanted to talk about in Azure today. And then I sidetracked you with OneDrive, and which sidetracked us into macOS. So I saw one announcement the other day, and I've not dove in and played with this yet, but Azure Premium SSD V2 disk storage is now in preview. So we now have a new iteration, a new version of premium SSDs in Azure that brings some speed improvements. They bring some updates even around IOPS, how IOPS works. So I was looking through this article, and right now your premium disk, your premium SSD, your ultra SSD, for instance, IOPS and baseline throughput here vary by disk size when you're doing ultra or the premium SSD V1. Once you start getting into premium SSD V2, they've switched the model here a little bit, and you get 3,000 IOPS for free, and you get 125 megabytes per second for free, and then you actually have the addition to buy additional throughput on it, additional IOPS, additional baseline throughput you can add on for a cost. So one thing that's nice about this is now if I need a crazy high amount of IOPS or throughput, I don't have to buy like a 60 terabyte disk to get it. I could still do like a 1 gigabyte. I could do a smaller disk and just pay for that increased throughput on these disks. And again, there's some other advantages we talked about, but that was the big one looking through that. I was like, I like how they changed that model in terms of throughput and speed on these.
Yeah, I think it's one of those places where there really hasn't been a decoupling between size of disk and performance of disk. I know I get this asked a lot from customers on the blob side, like, hey, just let me pay more for bandwidth, but you know, let me run with just a couple hundred terabyte workload instead of petabytes to get kind of the throughput that I need. So it's interesting to see that decoupling. I think the really interesting thing with this too is if you look at that decoupling, so say you're going to provision storage capacity from, you know, n gigabytes up to, you know, n tebibytes, it starts at 1 gigabyte, which is pretty tiny. So you start at 1 gigabyte, you get those 3,000 IOPS for free, you get the 125 megabits a second that you mentioned for free, but you can go up to a peak of 80,000 IOPS and 1,200 megabits a second, even on that 1 gigabyte, if that's all you need.
That's really nice.
Decoupling is super interesting to me, just as kind of like a business model and kind of how it's delivered as a service and maybe how customers pick it up and start to leverage it there. The other thing you have to keep in mind is these are still in the provisioned, what you provision is what you pay disk model, not what you use versus what you provision. So if you provision 100 gigabytes of disk, you are going to pay for 100 gigabytes, whether you're using 100 gigabytes or not. So just keep that in the back of your head. But hopefully this lets, you know, organizations really dial things in a little bit more. Maybe it helps you avoid striping disks together if that's something that you've been doing along the way. You should be able to get just down to really more perf theoretically better price. I think that's like TBD and potentially borne out in how customers can rationalize and use all this.
I haven't looked. Do they have anything around pricing for, here we go, Max IOPS. Pricing, SSD pricing will become available as of August 1. So we're not going to have to wait long. A couple weeks and then you will get pricing. You'll be able to provision up to 3,125 at no additional cost regardless. Yeah, so I'm assuming, does that mean it's coming out of preview that soon, or are they just going to have pricing nailed down here in the next couple of weeks?
I think you potentially
a little bit about, right? Yeah.
I'm not a PM in disks. I can't say.
Well, and you probably could say even
generally
if you
with
didn't
things
know.
Like this, you'll see a kind of a rapid march to GA for something like this. There are some limitations that exist in the current preview. I think those are important to call out along the way. Probably the biggest one is premium SSD V2 disks. So specifically these new ones that are in preview, they can't be used as an OS disk right now. They can also only be attached to zonal VMs. So just keep that in mind. Like if you're just deploying your VM regionally and you're letting Microsoft pick the zone for you in the background, you kind of need to be explicit and say, hey, this is a zonal VM that I'm standing up. They also can't be attached to virtual machines and a virtual machine scale set. I think that's a little bit of a downside today. And then snapshot support really isn't there. So you can't take a snapshot of a V2 disk right now, V2 premium SSD.
Yes, they're also only locally redundant.
All that being said, that stuff will kind of come over time and certainly as that march to GA goes on.
Yes, those will be, it'll be fun to go in and play with those because I remember too, like to get throughput, I used to do a lot of striping disks. So I'm curious to see as well what that pricing ends up being to buy additional IOPS. Like you said, I would imagine it's going to be cheaper than buying a bunch of disk space you don't need just to be able to stripe to get additional IOPS and throughput. So this will be a nice option to have here going forward.
I think if you're in the space where you understand what your performance constraints are and where you've potentially been running into walls, then this could be super helpful. Like one place I see this probably, you know, it's niche, but like SAP workloads, you know, they're going to have these needs for databases on the back end that are certainly maybe not going to be on the larger side, but are going to be more throughput or IOPS constrained. SQL databases is another great use case for those, right? Like you're very disk bound at some point. So having more options on the disk side certainly helps out there. So ideally what you see with these is like if you get to a place where you can adopt a premium SSD V2, it meets your performance, price, kind of, you know, all those dimensions, you see this place where you'll actually get better perf and not just better perf in like, you know, hey, I've got this throughput or IOPS right now, this second, but also measured over time. So once you get to like P99, P95, like latencies should be consistently lower and better kind of across all of those.
Most definitely. If you do want to try it out now, there is request access. So this is still a request access to get started. So we can put a link to that in the show notes. It may come out quick by the time this comes out. They may already be out from behind this request access close to GA, but have it in the show notes anyways if you're interested.
Yeah, so you do have to request. It is a gated preview. It's also limited regional availability, US East and West Europe today.
Yep. All right, so we have one more. Do you want to dive into the other topic you were talking about today?
Sure. Which one was that? Remind me.
Microsoft Azure cross-region load balancers. And even some of the load balancers in general, we talked about the other one that I'm drawing a blank on right now that just went GA, but there's some updates around load balancers in Azure.
Yes. So on the GA side of things, we talked about Gateway Load Balancer a couple of episodes back. So Gateway Load Balancer is effectively like a transparent device that can sit between your users and your MVAs, and it supports transparent traffic pass-through, so you don't have to worry about like SNET. You can maintain source IP and things like that. So we talked about that being in preview. Gateway Load Balancer, it was one of those that, hey, it just went to rapid GA. It took a couple of weeks. It is now available in all public regions, including China, and all of the GovClouds as well. So if you're deploying any type of stateful appliance, you've got like a network virtual appliance, IPS, IDS, firewall, whatever it happens to be, you're doing maybe like deep packet inspection, you put your own custom thing, whatever, into the network path, Gateway Load Balancer is potentially a good fit for you with super low management overhead. So that's out and about and kicking around. The other one that I thought was interesting in load balancer land is this thing called cross-region load balancer. So one of the limitations with load balancers is they get deployed in the same region. Like it's a PaaS service, but ultimately it's got to be a unit of compute. Like there has to be something networking that's running it. And that unit of compute and network was running in the same region as the load balancer would run in the same region as the application or workload that it fronted. And that kind of made sense because that thing needed access potentially to your VNets. You would want latency to be low. Like there's a bunch of considerations there for you. Maybe you had dependencies on like something else besides TCP, like you were dependent on UDP connections, and you know, you just wanted everything to work along the way. And if you wanted to go to a more global solution, maybe some like a global load balancer, maybe some folks look to things like Traffic Manager, but that's not really a TCP or UDP load balancer. That's a DNS load balancer. So not quite the same kind of thing. Like load balancers, typically we want to have the end user connection to my load balancer terminate at the load balancer, and then the load balancer can pass that traffic on, get it to my backend, say like web server, application server, and then get that response back and then go ahead and serve it back to the user that way. Traffic Manager really didn't get you there as a DNS load balancer because you hit Traffic Manager. Traffic Manager says, okay, what's the DNS endpoint that I need to connect to right now? And then it will send you as a client directly over to that workload. So they're kind of like different tools in the toolbox depending on what you have going on. So cross-region load balancer is just that. It's a load balancer that's deployed not globally, but it's deployed into a geo. So maybe like Azure AD is in a geo. This is in a geo as well. And that load balancer resource can then talk to you and direct traffic to backend application servers, web servers, whatever they happen to be, using that same 5-tuple hash that load balancer uses today to just route traffic between and then balance all that stuff out globally. So now the cool thing here is you can have basically like one DNS name, say that's tied to the IP on your cross-region load balancer, and then your cross-region load balancer handles all the traffic distribution to the backend, you know, that application instance that's sitting over in East US, and then, you know, the one that's in West US, and maybe the one that's in, you know, North Europe or Southeast Asia, whatever it happens to.
Yeah, and it looks like as you layer these two, you can... It has some scaling abilities in terms of scaling up and scaling down to new regions or different regions. If you have a global deployment across a bunch of regions. And it also looked like I saw reading through here that if that regional load balancer goes down, it'll auto fail over to the next closest regional load balancer.
Yeah. So that's the interesting thing. It's a geo / global thing. I haven't spent a bunch of time playing with it or trying to get one to like fall over on the side and see what it does. I'd be interested in getting it there. It's really like if a region failed, then your traffic just gets routed to the next closest healthy regional load balancer. So let's say you're deployed in in, you know, West Europe, then maybe West Europe goes down and you fall over to North Europe. Or you could say, I'm going to do a cross-region load balancer that redirects between Europe and West US. So I'm going to go from like West Europe to West US, same kind of thing. It'll just handle the failover, figure out all the paths that it needs and get itself to where it needs to be. That's pretty nifty.
Yeah. And if you're looking for different things, so there's also one of the articles here we're reading about, it's a cross-regional load balancer. It's also known as the global tier of a standard load balancer. So it's it sounds like it's tiering on top of that standard load balancer, just adding functionality, that regional functionality or cross-region functionality.
I think if you were somebody who was looking at like Traffic Manager and you're saying like, no, DNS distribution isn't what works for me, but I really do have needs around global redundancy, then this is a great option for you. And ideally, this stacks on kind of your overall redundancy play within your workload. Like you've got this load balancer, cross-region load balancer that potentially fronts, like you said, other load balancers that then exist in region, wherever they happen to be, and then they have their VM scale sets and everything else behind
them. So this is a very cool solution. We'll have to, maybe this is one, Scott. I wonder if we can figure out how to play with this one on YouTube. I wonder how much that would cost us.
I'm sure we could figure it out. A little bit of Blaze meter in your life. You know, we direct some traffic this way, that way.
Exactly. We might have to go play with this one because this one is intriguing as well on how it all works. And then we just have to try to simulate failures and pull plugs and delete random stuff and all that.
How hard could it be?
Yeah, exactly.
Said Ben and Scott as they postulated in the last 30 seconds of their podcast.
I mean, you've heard our podcast. We apparently have the innate ability to break stuff, or at least I do. But yeah, with that, anything else, Scott? It is.
No, I think that'll wrap us up, I think.
Covers all of our topics for today. It was a good overview of some Apple news, some cloud news, some other news, a little bit of all the news. But we did talk about YouTube a little bit. And if you are curious with more stuff around that, or you have questions you'd like us to answer in a future episode, feel free, reach out on Twitter. We're at MS Cloud IT Pro on Twitter through our MS Cloud IT Pro podcast members Discord, which is where we do all the YouTube stuff as well. If you want to listen while we record live, ask questions, discuss. We have a monthly membership that includes a bunch of other benefits like that. In terms of the Discord, YouTube, the show being recorded as we record it each week. And if you want to go sign up for that, learn more about that, you can go to msclouditpro.com/membership. So thanks to those members that have supported the show so far. And thanks to our sponsor of the show, IntelliJink.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.